Council's Committee on Human Resources, March 30th, 1987, public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2067 and 2354.
Committee bill introduction. And I'll read you the measure summary. Establishes comprehensive prenatal care program for low-income parents funded by 1 cent per pack. This is not supposed to be an increase.
No, it's not supposed to be an increase.
Cigarettes are getting expensive.
Establishes, you know, we're going to have this amended right away if the measure summary does not read correctly. Establishes comprehensive prenatal care program for low-income parents funded by 1 cent per pack. It says increase in cigarette tax, funds medical assistance for needy pregnant women, funds increase in medically needy income level for eligibility to maximum allowed under federal law. Okay, bill was drafted. Well, just wait a minute, Representative Van Loon. The bill was drafted at my request. Okay. Was that your question?
Well, I wondered what we were dealing with.
What we're dealing with is to find a way, Representative Van Loon, to fund the programs for pregnant women and prenatal care for children under 5 without going to the general fund. As you know, right now, the state will only provide medical assistance for those people at 65% or below of the federal poverty level. What this does is an attempt to fund people up to 100% of the federal poverty level.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shipwright.
I'd move that LC as a committee bill.
Thank you, Representative Shipwright. Any objection?
No, but just a matter of fact. Does this include smokeless tobacco, too?
Oh, well, it's me. It only says cigarette tax. Yeah.
Okay.
No, let's go ahead. He's not even giving us a copy of it.
Mr. Chair, I'll fix the amendment. Get the amendments.
Okay, any objection?
No.
If not, bill is introduced as a committee bill. Okay, we'll open the hearing on House Bill 2067. I'd like to call Christine Gebby and Lynn Perlman. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Christine Gebby, Administrator of the Health Division. And am very pleased to present to you House Bill 2067, which is a complete modernization of the Oregon statutes regarding reporting and investigation and follow-up of reportable diseases. The sheet of paper you've been handed is an outline of the key features of the bill, but let me give you just a few words of background so you'll know something of why this is introduced. In the last 2 years, because of interest in a new communicable disease, HIV infection and AIDS, more people have read Oregon's communicable disease statutes than had ever read them in the preceding 80 years. In the course of doing so, we identified a number of flaws in our existing statutes. And what this bill attempts to do is to bring our statutes up to a modern standard, accounting for the kinds of conditions that state and local health departments look into, and for the procedures we should use to do that. First major activity involved with that is to repeal Chapter 434, the existing venereal disease statute. The existing statutes artificially separate diseases into communicable and venereal. That is an artificial separation. It does not hold true. Many diseases are communicated several ways. And the existing venereal disease statute has several features and assumptions related to prostitutes and their clients, advertising of cures, prohibition of sale of cures, that just don't make sense in the current world. So we propose repealing that statute entirely, but taking from it some good pieces and introducing them with other revisions into Chapter 433, which is the main communicable disease statute. one of the first things we try to do with 433, and that's what's entailed in Section 1 of the bill, is to insert some additional definitions. The existing statutes have almost no definitions in them beyond who the assistant director that the assistant director means the assistant director for health of the Department of Human Resources. This identifies local public health administrator, property, what a public health measure is, and so on. The other revisions, sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and we can go through these in great detail if you like, 7, 8, and 9, I'm just going to summarize those all together, change the language so that it does refer properly to the local health administrator rather than the local health officer or public health officer. That's to catch this statute up to other statutes that have been changed in the intervening years. To specify more plainly how diseases get to be reportable and that we have to do that by rule, adopt into the communicable disease statute the safeguards on confidentiality which previously applied only to venereal diseases, and we didn't think that was appropriate, and then identifies the use of restrictive measures. The largest volume of this bill as you have it in front of you is sections 10 and 11, which deal in fact with the due process procedures should the state or a local health department wish to impose a restrictive measure such as quarantine. The present statutes provide no specificity other than allowing us to do that. As I have visited with several people about this bill, I've pointed out that under the present statute, I could sit here and write out a quarantine order and hand it to someone and say, you are hereby quarantined because I think you've got a dangerous disease. And there would be no clear directions where you could go to get review of that, to get relief from it, to demand the burden of proof be on me that you are dangerous and so on. And working with several individuals, including the Civil Liberties Union, the AIDS Policy Committee, a county council, an attorney in private practice, we have identified a procedure that is somewhat like the civil commitment procedure used for mental disorders that assures any time we restrict a person, we tell them clearly what their rights are and they go through it. The key to that, and I do want to call it to your attention, is found on page 4 of the bill, starting with lines 37, which outlines the finding or the standard which we have to meet before we would seek to restrict someone, that the person poses a substantial threat to public health, that they are unable or unwilling to behave so as not to expose others, and the measure we propose is both necessary and the least restrictive alternative. So the burden falls on us to have exhausted all other alternatives before such an action. The final section of the bill proposes and continues the present penalties for violation of this statute. We're particularly concerned with penalties against any public health official who violates the confidentiality of records which are in their possession. Three other things to point out. First, as we go through, we use the word afflicted rather than infected to point out that public health today deals not just with communicable viruses but also with toxic substances. Several local health departments are today involved with actions that involve mercury contamination of property. So we wanted the language to reflect toxic substances as well as germs as things which threaten the public health and for which a public health order might be necessary. The other two things are errors in the printed bill that, as far as I can tell, are related to the drafting and follow-up process. One is on page 5, line 26, where there is where the word evidence appears two places about five words apart, and the second word should be petition, so it should read evidence on which the petition is based. We proofread this several times and didn't catch that. And likewise, on page 6, also on line 26, the phrase by a county court should not appear there. I think that got in by error because we were working off some of the statutes for civil commitment where that phrase has appeared in the past.
Mr. Chairman, may we go back to that last reference just a minute?
Sure.
You must have given her a time limit here.
No, I didn't.
I just tend to talk very fast. I'm sorry, Representative Van Leeuwen.
Page 6, what line?
Line
26. Page 5, line 26, and page 6, line 26. So the two corrections.
And what should page 5, line 26 say?
Evidence on which the petition is based, rather than evidence on which the evidence is based.
Okay, then you gave another one after that.
Then on page 6, line 26, to remove the phrase by a county court.
Just remove
it. Just remove it entirely. That was not intended to be in there, and we missed that on going back through. My 90 mile an hour style. I'm sorry. I get started talking fast. I would be happy to go into detail on any section of the bill to compare it to the present statute or clarify it. Mr. Perlman from the Department of Justice is here. Is a services legal counsel of the Health Division, was a part of the process of drafting this and can also be helpful in answering specific questions. I think about choice of words if you have them.
Okay. Do members of the committee have questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ford.
For either of you, I understand the need to clarify and to put some restrictions in who can be quarantined and how. Has this caused any problem or any misunderstanding from groups who might think that something new is going into the law to quarantine, especially those who are concerned about AIDS?
Yes, it has, because people who don't understand the present statute think that this statute is introducing new authority into the law rather than restricting an authority which is already there. We have tried to meet with those groups and provide clarification on that, and it's my understanding that the groups that had raised that question, including some of the gay rights groups and AIDS service organizations, are now reassured that this is not intended in any way to introduce a new authority.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Van Loon.
A follow-up on that question, though. Didn't you just tell us that this was some new authority as far as dealing with toxic substances was concerned?
It is new language. We do now deal with toxic substances, state and local health departments do, but the statute under which we do that does not explicitly state toxic substances. It's been our interpretation of the statute, so we're proposing making that a very blunt piece of the law.
Can you point us to the section of the bill that deals specifically with that? All of the sections, I guess, of the bill deal with that.
Section
13. I know it's back here at the bench. Yeah. Well, no, the reportability would be the reportability. Okay. Thank you. Too many lines. To use the quarantine authority for toxic substances would be page 4, line 35. The subject of the petition is contaminated with or contains property contaminated with a toxic substance. But more broadly, under reportability, is the change of a definition of reportable diseases, which is a disease or condition, the reporting of which would enable us to take action to protect or benefit the public health. And then in specifying reportable diseases, we would specify toxic substances as well.
Now, where are you reading that from?
The definition of reportable disease is on page 1, line 23. And then it's followed by a specific definition of toxic substance on line number 8, line 25.
Okay, and then where else in the bill is it dealt with?
Any place.
Section 10 is important, Chris.
Section 10.
Very important.
Deals specifically.
Oh, section 13 on page 10. Yeah. Take a look at that one. That's okay. The big one, I think.
That section 13 deals with the right to stop conveyances entering the state. Again, that is an existing authority, which we have under ORS 4, or present statute, 433, but specifies more clearly that it could be done for either communicable diseases or toxic substances.
Christy, where is that specified?
The public conveyances?
No, you're saying that you already have that authority. Where is it specified?
It's in ORS 433. .216. If the assistant director finds there's an imminent risk of the introduction of any dangerous communicable disease into the state by means of any public or private conveyance, you can detain it. 433.216.
Yeah,
but that's new.
That's existing language.
All right, but what my question, Christy, was on page 10, line 28, you have the introduction of a toxic substance that folks can, start dealing with that.
Yeah.
In your testimony, you indicated that you already had that authority. What I need to know is where in the law, not in 433.216, that's new language, where in the present law do you have the authority over toxic substances?
Our authority is not specified to toxic substances in 431. In the general authority of the health division to follow up on any substance which may cause a disease, we have interpreted that to include toxic materials as well as infectious agents. So, for example, our follow up on watermelons contaminated with a pesticide a couple of summers ago was under that general authority. What we're doing in this statute is tying down that more general authority would propose to do with specific language regarding reportable diseases.
In other words, right now you have rule authority, the rules being under your own control. What this does is create a statutory authority in that regard, which I think is a policy decision that the committee needs to be aware of. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abram.
Well, along that same line, Chris, it occurred to me when you first started talking about it that I always think of the DEQ in terms of the management of toxic substances in the state, and I just guess which I'd ask you if you can tell me about what their statutes are and how they manage the introduction and use and transportation and so forth of toxic substances, and whether or not this is redundant or whether it dovetails. What's the relationship there? I just don't understand that.
I do not see it as redundant. They manage the supervision of industries or other groups which might be putting toxic substances into the environment of Oregon, the discharge of industrial waste, for example, into a watershed or into the air. We become concerned when there is direct exposure of people to that substance. So let me stick with the pesticide example. The Health Division doesn't supervise the application of pesticides to food in the field. That's Department of Agriculture. Nor do we supervise the disposal of the waste from a pesticide applicating company. But where a contaminated food substance is introduced into the food chain and people start eating watermelons that gives them symptoms, then we want to act quickly to remove them from the shelf in collaboration with agriculture to follow up on them. What this statute does is make it very clear that we can make reportable such exposure to a toxic substance so that a case of disease caused by pesticide that might be identified by a physician would be reportable to us in the same way that a case of measles is reportable. Again, that happens now informally and under our general authority and through our relationship with physicians, but the growing interest in that area makes it seem appropriate that we make very plain that that is our intention to follow up on that kind of disease caused by substances as well as disease caused by infectious agents.
May I just,
Representative Bigger,
nail that down a little bit,
and then we'll go to Representative Gold.
Good. Let's take another case. Let's take a case of PCBs, which exist in the industrial environment, and the old transformers and so forth. You know all that. How? It is discovered that for many years PCBs had been spilled on the ground, soaked up in the soil on an industrial site. And suddenly that's discovered. And it's discovered by the DEQ, because they're the ones that are out there looking for that sort of thing. The DEQ would want you to dig it all up and pack it off into a refuge. I don't know what they want to do. I mean, the stuff doesn't degrade, so that's the problem with it. Now, what interest would the Health Division have? The DEQ has identified the fact that this contamination exists, and they have rules and regulations regarding how you're to handle that contamination and so forth. It is a health hazard, of course, because that's why you're doing it. What would this cause, this new language, what interest or involvement would the Health Division have in that kind of a circumstance that it doesn't have or now?
Nothing different than what it is now, which is DEQ would be responsible for that because it's a known substance and they have the authority to deal with it. Where we might become involved is if a person living adjacent to that site suddenly went into their physician and said, I've got twitches in my left shoulder and I think I'm turning green and I'm quite convinced it's the dirt out there that did it. We would then become involved with that patient's physician evaluating whether there was any reason to believe that was the problem. And if for some reason arrived at such a conclusion, might then want to come back to DEQ and consult with them about taking more aggressive measures to manage the site or something like that. This would not remove their authority in any way.
Okay. Representative Gold?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'll give fair warning. I have 6 questions, each of which have some parts to them, and for me, I feel a need to establish a consistent record, and Christine knows that I have these, and so the committee members will bear with me. I think it'll help us out. Some of it may be redundant. I came in late, and I apologize.
Well, we haven't had any discussion of any of the issues that your questions bring up, so your questions will act as a good introduction to the bill.
Okay, and I've drawn them out of the policy mm-hmm. committee report, and perhaps the best way to do with the first question is to ask the several parts of it, and then Christine, just go ahead and do whatever you do. The first one relates to page 28 of the policy committee report, and it's how do you intend to exercise the quarantine authority granted by HB 2067 for persons infected with HIV, ARC, or AIDS? Do you intend to exercise this authority only when other less restrictive measures have been exhausted or found to be unworkable? And would you give us some examples of situations where you believe quarantine would be appropriate?
While the current quarantine statute and the revised statute as written could apply in cases of AIDS, at this point I would have no intention of exercising that authority because it is very difficult to imagine a situation involving HIV infection where quarantine would be the appropriate measure to take. And it would only be exercised when we had exhausted absolutely every other recourse. Remember that the method of spreading HIV infection is blood or semen, usually through either sexual interaction or through sharing needles used in illicit drug use. And it is not like putting somebody in a private room so they can't breathe on other people to prevent a disease spreading, which might be done with tuberculosis. So that if a person were found to be infected with the HIV virus, the first avenue is to educate that person about what has gone on, what they've got in their body, and what they can do to keep from spreading it to other people. If a person were so educated and still either demonstrated by activity or verbalized an intent to keep on having sexual activity or keep on sharing needles with other people, then we would attempt to refer them into a more intensive counseling and supportive situation, or attempt to find them voluntarily some different living situation where they could be supported and would not feel a need to continue engaging in risky activities that would spread the disease to others. If that were exhausted and we had an individual with no family who was otherwise sane and not subject to some problem under the civil commitment statutes, was clearly putting others at risk by, for example, denying their infectious status and having sex with repeated other partners. And we could get absolutely no voluntary help from their family or friends to keep them in some kind of restricted setting. Then, in that very, very rare instance, we might consider application of the quarantine portion of the statute. But it is very hard for me to imagine that would happen.
Okay. May I go on?
Certainly.
The second question relates to a portion of page 62 of the policy committee report. And again, I'll read the several parts of it for you to get the gist of it. What provisions do you intend to make in administrative rules to require documented informed consent for HIV testing? And is legislation required to prohibit such testing except when consent has been given or case law exceptions apply?
A couple of parts of that. We are pursuing clarifying our administrative rules for HIV testing in the public health setting, and such change rules will clarify the informed consent. The statutory basis for informed consent is not complete and would be better served by some changes. That was an area which the policy committee did not get fully, didn't get a whole statute drafted by the time they got done with their report. But the ACLU has in fact drafted such a proposed statute, and I have had a chance to review a draft with them. It's my understanding they have sought a sponsor for that. And I think we would be well advised as a state to seek such a statute if we can. I think case law is quite clear that informed consent is the norm, and that violation of informed consent would put one subject to problems. I believe one of the later witnesses, who is an attorney familiar with health care law, might be able to elaborate on that a little more, or Mr. Perlman might want to elaborate on that.
I think I defer to Mr. Fong. I think he's probably familiar.
Yeah.
Okay. The third question relates to page 64 of the policy committee report. Do you plan to establish administrative rules to identify those occupations where testing for AIDS, ARC, or HIV infection is appropriate?
Were we to identify such an occupation, we would do so by administrative rule, but at this point, I am not aware of any occupation for which we would identify that, and the division would actively oppose any employer that came to seeking our advice, thinking they wish to use this blood test in an employment setting.
Okay. Question four relates to portions of page 66. Do you support enacting a confidentiality statute prohibiting disclosure without consent of any medical information, including HIV test results, ARC, or AIDS diagnosis?
Yes, I am very supportive of such a measure. I tend to view this material right now as not disclosable without consent. Our agency works very hard to protect it and encourages any other healthcare practitioner to do so, and to the extent that a statute would help us on that, I very much support it.
Question five relates to page 31 of the policy committee report. Do you plan to establish administrative rules to require reporting categories of HIV infection other than AIDS diagnosis through the anonymous system proposed in the policy committee report?
Yes, we do. That right now, as I think members of the committee knows, only AIDS, the most extreme form of this infection, is reportable. The policy committee proposes a system where we could make the full spectrum of infection reportable, which would be good information for us to have, but does so through a method which protects the identity of individuals. And I'm very supportive of that portion of the report, and we intend to proceed with adoption of rules.
And the final one, relating to page 80 of the policy committee report, do you expect the HIV/AIDS policy committee to continue to exist? And if so, how often do you expect to convene meetings of the committee?
Yes, I expect it to continue to exist. Some funding to support it is included in the governor's revised AIDS budget, which has been presented to the Ways and Means Committee. It is meeting in April. We have not set a frequency of dates after that, but I'm sure it will be at least quarterly, and I would guess more frequently based on the number of AIDS-related issues that keep coming up.
Thank you very much, Christine.
Thank you, Representative Gould. Other questions?
What's HIV test?
You want to answer that?
That was a term that...
That's testing for... HIV is the proper name of the virus which causes AIDS, and it is testing for the antibody to that virus. That's the testing we're now doing in the community.
Representative French?
Christine, if a quarantine facility was established, who pays for that? Does that come out of general fund or out of the health department?
If a quarantine takes place, the cost of maintaining the person in quarantine is borne by the local health department if they're the ones who did the quarantine, or by the state health division if we were the ones that ordered it. And right now, quarantine is ordered about once or twice a year, usually for tuberculosis patients, and the cost of caring for that patient while quarantine is borne at the local level.
That's true. That's under present law.
Under present law and under this statute.
Okay, other questions?
One final question. You proposed in section